And movies will work, but if they don't, I'll do some kind of interpretive dance if that's necessary. So I'm going to talk about actually not much physics and not much math, more about what I would call a shifting scene in medicine and a huge opportunity for people to get involved from an engineering and mathematics perspective. The title is called Shifting Targets, Image-Guided Radiotherapy Design and Delivery. Not radiotherapy specifically, but in fact any kind of therapy in its design and delivery. And shifting targets, that phrase comes from what we do a lot of every day. We try to position the patient very well, but it's also something that Andy von Eschenbach, who is the director of the National Cancer Institute in the U.S., has started to do with respect to research in the management of cancer. He had this nice article when he was the center of medical progress in the Manhattan Institute called Eliminating the Suffering and Death Due to Cancer by 2015. And he has a number of interesting comments on here. Andy has this very difficult situation in that Nixon said we have a war on cancer, 25 years we should be done, and we'll work on prevention, and we're not there yet. So he's got this problem he has to try to resolve. He has to come through with some kind of a delivery on this promise. And he's taken a shift in tack, which is substantial. And he basically, referring to cancer, now we need fresh thinking about new goals, goals that remain focused on as a cure, but as a long-term solution for controlling cancer. So not focusing so much, in fact, he used the phrase, on the magic bullet, but the realization that we can now have a strategy for many interventions capable of preempting the cancer process. So sort of a real recognition of the fact that the managed cancer is occurring now, and we can't just wait for a magic bullet. It really strikes the conversations we had earlier about whether or not can you track down that individual cell. Maybe one solution can't do that, but maybe it's a triage or a combination of multiple solutions to go after it. So I'm going to talk about a kind of therapy, and Mike has already alluded to it, that is used heavily. In fact, about 50% of all patients diagnosed with cancer receive radiation therapy. And this kind of picture really brings the concept home. Here we would have a target defined by some imaging modality. That's only recent, in fact, and only the past decade or so we'd be using real 3D imaging modalities to identify that target. And then we would concentrate some energy, joules per kilogram, a relatively small quantity of energy, as Mike pointed out, to that target. And that sets about a process of preferentially killing cancer cells compared to normal tissue cells. Quite an amazing process. And we started to do this a very, very long time ago. And I'm going to give a bit of a history on how slowly we've engineered improvements for this process, yet how huge the opportunity is right now to accelerate the solution and how we apply it. Röntgen discovered in the fall of 1995 x-rays in his house, or something close to his house. And he worked very hard, published a fantastic paper. In fact, he gave his first lecture on it in the start of 1896. By mid-1896, they were using radiation to treat cancer in the U.S. And one of the guys that was involved early on, although he has a questionable history, he had a number of observations that he submitted in 1902. First of all, the X-ray is the most remarkable therapeutic agent of the last decade. I don't know what he was comparing to. Snake oil, Coca-Cola. The X-ray, this is an amazing observation, the X-ray has a selective influence upon cells of the body, abnormal cells being affected more readily than normal. This is what Mike pointed out, this differential and repair capacity. And quite frankly, that's an aspect of radiotherapy we've leaned on very heavily for the past 90 years. The use of X-ray is, without doubt, this is a little compliment to Mike, a very valuable addition to therapeutics of malignant disease and cannot demand too much attention from the progressive physician. There you go. So let's look at some pictures. So these are pictures provided from a patient with advanced basive tongue cancer seen by Dr. O'Sullivan at Princess Margaret Hospital. And here we have clearly visualized on MR what would be considered gross tumor volume here, as well as some extension into those neck nodes. So as Mike pointed out, how the structures in the body drain. And the way we would have treated this is now a sagittal cut, so I apologize for the lack of contrast, but you don't need much to get the idea. This is the volume that would be targeted, plus the surrounding nodes. We would have applied a radiation dose over, let's say, 40 treatment fractions, several weeks that was like this. And so what we're doing in this process is relying very heavily on what Grube reported in his very early observations, that we rely on the selective differential between the cancer tissues responding from the normal tissues, and we rely on it heavily. And this is standard of practice until about, 5 years ago. And still applied this way heavily. But it works. Amazing. That's why we use it. But the engineering between what Röntgen had and what Grube started and what we were doing until about 10 years ago was remarkably unaltered. But this process obviously isn't so simple. We can't just rely on what Grube observed as differential and selection between the two processes. This is another slice right through here. Anybody who eats steak would know that sometimes when you eat something, you get this remarkable sensation that's from the response of the salivary glands. And the salivary glands produce saliva within. It puts fluid in your mouth and it makes life pleasant. If you don't have those, you get very severe dry mouth. And the patients who go through radiotherapy, we have this unfortunate issue where we irradiate these and reduce their volume substantially and their saliva production substantially. So here's a case where those are normal structures in there, yet we're having a negative influence on them as a byproduct. So there's been a substantial engineering effort over the past decade to change the way we apply radiation therapy. It's called the 3D hypothesis. If we conform dose to the target, do we still get good control and reduce toxicity? So we used to treat like this. Imagine these four beams coming from different directions. We definitely hit the target, but we hit a lot of normal structures. And it's just a simple shift, some mechanical engineering, electromechanical systems that would allow us to shape the radiation applied to something more conformal, completely rational. In fact, we've now got systems that let us not just shape it in such a way, but we could actually apply a distribution of fluences from a variety of orientations to reconstruct the desired distribution of dose within the patient, and that's called intensity-modulated radiation therapy. So every patient that presents to us has a different form and distribution of normal and target structures, and we try to then respond by shaping the beams appropriately. So we can go from that case where we had what was managed traditionally to something much more like this, where here we're covering the base of tongue and we're identifying that unilateral node and taking the dose up there and avoiding the cord in the middle. You can see the cord right through here. This is a huge improvement, and we're rolling this out across the industry substantially. So it's a big opportunity for improving radiotherapy. So let's look back at what Eschenbach said. He thinks it's a big opportunity to bring tools. So here we'll not just use targeted mechanistic-based therapy strategies, but technology also enables us to see the impact of our intervention on patients in real time. So there's another new trend coming into radiation therapy, and that is the development of imaging technologies at the time of treatment. One of the risks is, and one of the uncertainties is, where we place that radiation dose every day. So some of these technologies integrate the treatment beam, as I showed earlier, with imaging systems that are orthogonal to it to allow us to generate visualization of the patient at the time of treatment. This addresses a lot of geometric uncertainty issues, allowing us to apply the radiation dose with greater fidelity. So one of the technologies we developed and is now a commercial product is cone beam computed tomography, and I'll touch on it very briefly. It's not the focus of the talk, but this is where engineering has given us really fantastic quality radiographs, so high quality and such a high quality at low dose that we can take some 300 to 600 of them as we rotate around the patient. It's then possible through reconstruction schemes, computed tomography reconstruction schemes, to go from what appears a series of shadows to an estimate of the density of the objects or the attenuation coefficient of that object presented in front of it. And that happens to be what happens in a CT scan. So this creates an opportunity for us to have, in a single environment, the treatment machine and the ability to generate an image of the patient at the time of therapy. So how would we use this? Well, very simply, we could then image the patient, see what we should be treating, and apply a shift to the patient, because it's very difficult to infer the location of the inside of the patient based on the skin on the outside of the patient. You can all imagine that's not easy. So this has a huge opportunity for us to increase the precision and accuracy with which we apply radiation therapy. So it's a big shift. And you don't just get a single slice, you get many slices. In fact, here's a more of a complete process where you can acquire the data sets, reconstruct, and put it into a software tool, which is geometrically calibrated to the treatment machine that would allow us to redesign the treatment, or as a minimum, just shift the patient. So the rollout of this technology is occurring quite quickly in radiation therapy. Within Princess Margaret Hospital, we're focusing very much on the development of shifting all of our treatments to this kind of an approach where we can image, adjust, and treat, all for the purpose of reducing our reliance on what Grube identified, this preferential selection. Why rely on the biology if we can use the engineering to avoid the normal structures and not rely so heavily on that preferential selection? So the difference in image information in the context room is huge. So when you say it's the volume of information is dramatic. So anybody who works in information theory should suddenly say, here's an opportunity. We go from two images like this, images of gold seeds that were placed in the prostate and used to direct the therapy, to an image like we see on the right-hand side. Just a huge increase in the amount of information. So this is an image through here, a prostate cancer patient. You can see the bladder. You could have seen the bladder. You can see structures in the muscle. Much more information than, in fact, we need just to guide the radiation therapy. This is the bladder. So we're targeting the prostate located right in here. Or in the case of lung cancer, this is what we plan to do. This is what we did on day one. This is what we did on day two. This is what we did on day three. Lung cancers are more difficult to hit because you're breathing. The breathing part is good, but the fact is that the lesion moves up and down. So the ability to actually refine how well, this is an engineering refinement to the application of a therapy, and relax our dependence on Grube's observation, I think is key. We can more than just see this gross description of the tumor. Maybe we can see more. So this is a visualization of a patient undergoing treatment for sarcoma. It's a kind of cancer in muscle cells. And you can see very nicely the lesion itself visualized at the time of treatment. So here you're presenting that to the therapist, information they've never been used to seeing. So it's a very interesting data handling decision issue. But the decisions get much more intriguing. You can see the detail. When you realize that that target you set out to treat on week one is subtly different on week two, is subtly different on week three, we would expect it. We're treating the patient. It's an expected response. So the idea of a fixed plan set out at initial conditions and expecting it to apply over the course of therapy is how radiotherapy is traditionally applied. But it's clear you are in the situations where you have inconsistencies between what you intend and what you're doing. So this automatically evokes a feedback loop for which there are virtually no tools available, commercially at least, if not in the research domain. So we can imagine something very nice where every day we shift the patient to make sure we hit the target, something like a really fast online feedback correction loop. There's all kinds of opportunities for decision theory and loop optimization in here. We can also imagine having to go on the yellow track when things just don't seem to make sense. The plan should not be the plan. We need plan B, plan C. And that will evoke all kinds of other pieces of information. Information about, let's say, additional CT scans, maybe PET images, something that lets us look at functional data, or maybe MR would provide us the greatest detail we need to make that adjustment. But clearly, new information coming back into the process. This is the opportunity that Mike pointed out, is adaptation. So change in response to the change we're inducing. And it's interesting that Eschenbach pulled this out as well, to see whether you have altered or changed the biochemistry of the tumor. Here, maybe not the biochemistry, maybe it's physical manifestation. Maybe the biochemistry, maybe we could have PET agents that allow us to visualize hypoxia, for example, which is something that's been worked on, and thus know whether you're achieving the desired therapeutic effect. If not, the therapeutic plan can be changed. So not so mechanistic, not so build a little boat and push it out from the water, but rather build a steering system or a guidance system into that. So here's a little graph I've been working up lately, and it kind of describes how typical medical intervention is done. You have a patient who is sick, has been diagnosed, and you would have, let's say, a response condition of zero, and you'd really like them to get them to response condition of one, i.e. they've responded. And there's a whole bunch of possible interventions you could consider, radiation, surgery, chemotherapy, all to get them to try to cross this line of one. So someone will look at information, published clinical trials, population-based outcomes, and the physician will design, at this point in time, the ballistics to achieve control with an accepted level of toxicity. The reality is that all the patients that go through this have completely different therapeutic trajectories through that space. There may be gradual changes in response arriving them to the point, maybe no response and then dramatic response, which we have very little information about the actual trajectory of that response through the space. There may also be patients that, for example, just don't get to control. In other words, they fail treatment, and all they have to live with is the toxicity and the failed treatment condition. So it's pretty clear that if we recognize there's a line and a path between point A and point B, maybe we could optimize the motion along this path. So we can identify a model that is not just straight prognostics at the start, but adaptive prognostics. In other words, we start to change the decision to occur during the course of therapy. This makes the therapy much more complex. So here, we had the ballistics we set out in blue to hit the green dot, and let's say the patient was going to fail. At some point in time, T0, we could make a measurement, record the change in response with intervention, and make a recorrection to the path. Or the patient, in fact, that was going to respond with excess toxicity, make an adjustment, and then reduce the variability in outcome for these patients. This is a completely feasible consideration, but it's extremely complex. to support this process, we need to really work on models. Models that have both functional elements of both disease and the normal process, populate the parameters associated with this model, and track the changes in this model as intervention progresses. This is completely feasible to pursue. It's called an adaptive treatment process. And here is an example where we're drawing on image-based information. That's why the imaging model is so exciting. It's a relatively non-invasive way to characterize the response. We could cast that objective, the objective of the therapy, against this information and design a therapy, monitor its response, make changes if necessary, so a feedback loop is established. We've been looking at this in radiation therapy, where we use these pieces of information to design the therapy, monitor what's going on, at least in terms of positioning and maybe shape change, to try to redesign the therapy. So we need some tools for this. This is an example where we need some help. So one of the problems is, as Mike pointed out, we don't just get a single image, we get thousands of images. So the amount of information provided and the need to reduce that information to something that can feed back into a controller, maybe just a description of shape, maybe a description of mean value, a single value for a much more complicated image is key. So we need to build systems or compression schemes. They can be lossy, but not so lossy that we lose the information that's necessary. And to go from images to parameters and models. This is a tool set we're working with, built with medical systems, in which we take an image, which is a grayscale distribution, and try to populate a model specific to that individual. Here is a bone model, just specifically for the femoral head, where they take population-based estimates of the shape and cast that against the gradients in the image in a competition. And that competition is between the external energy, the desire of the surface to arrive at a gradient of the image that would correspond to the difference between bone and surrounding tissue, and fighting against an internal energy, where the internal energy has been designed by looking at many, many, many femoral heads across many patients. This is an interesting competition. When the two competing components fix, we arrive at the best estimate of the model for that individual patient. So now they have such tools. So within our planning system that I showed you earlier, it's feasible now. These are in testing. So look at the lung in an image, and spinal cord actually in this case, and a bunch of other structures shown, and look at models that actually grow with prior knowledge of the shape of the structure, populate the parameters of those models for the individual patient to convert these many, many images from images to something we can work with in achieving our objective. It just continues on, it's a movie. The next thing that's difficult is that you'll never see the same image of a patient twice because the patient isn't configured the same way necessarily when you image them. Their stomach could be full, their stomach could be empty, their lungs could be at a different point of inhalation than before. So how is it possible to track where we're putting the radiation dose, for example, over a time course for these patients? So we have to evoke and develop deformation models, methods of tracking the application of dose to a functional sub-element within the tissues, even though that element could be moving up and down as the patient breathes, even though it could be changing shape or shrinking as we apply the radiation. So Christy Brock, one of the research associates in our program, has been working up a tool she calls Morpheus, and it's based on finite element models, evoking mechanical descriptions of the tissues and driving those based on contours identified in the images. This has a number of values. First of all, you can use it to register images. You can use it to quantify physiological motion, so displacement of a liver as you breathe in and out. That happens, and if we're trying to treat liver cancer, obviously that's problematic. You can use it to fuse two pieces of images and augment one with other information. Or alternatively, you can use it to quantify treatment response. The key thing here is using this as a tool to get around the fact that the body doesn't maintain its shape. So how can we look at response in tissues if the body itself is changing its shape? So eliminating those changes and addressing those changes so we can resolve those changes which are just due to natural occurrence and those changes which are due to the resolution of the disease. So I'm going to show you a little bit of early results on a geometric adaptive radiation therapy strategy where we have pre-treatment imaging and planning, CT or MR for example. We localize the target. Oops, there's a little bit of animation in here. We decide the process to take forward, whether it's online, whether it's a decision to make no intervention on behalf of the patient, or whether we correct online, and we deliver a treatment fraction. We then can monitor what changes in shape we had and then rerun this process again, the option to redesign the therapy. So every day the patient would be treated, or every week during the course of treatment, we would treat the treatment as a new opportunity to reoptimize. So we've been doing this for patients that have head and neck cancer, like the one I showed on earlier. In fact, I'll pick up a piece of that in part of the story. One of the structures to avoid in head and neck cancers is the parotid glands that I told you earlier. We've been doing some interesting studies and observing that in patients under the course of radiation therapy, their parotid glands can shrink by about a factor of 2. So we will design a therapy to avoid parotid glands. Yet, by weeks 1, 2, and 3, the parotid glands that we're trying to avoid have shrunk in volume by almost 30%. So the question is it a consideration to have a reoptimization given the new presentation of the problem? It's a difficult situation because you have to deal with the dose you've already put in. So I'm not going to go through the details, but I'll tell you that there's a lot of pieces in there. So here's, for example, is a set of parotid glands in green. This is viewing a patient head-on, changing over the course of radiation therapy. So traditionally, we would design therapy and proceed with relatively minor changes. But this just shows you how those two lateral structures, the green ones, are shrinking over the course of radiation therapy. So we've gone about a process of taking all this information, putting it into an adaptive radiotherapy process in which those structures are segmented in a semi-automatic fashion like I showed in the tools. Individual structures within those are tracked in a deformation model. We then will design the radiation therapy according to each of those changes. So literally, the system would adapt to the geometric presentation of the structures. And we have some early results. So what are the list of pieces we're using? The computational elements: image registration, segmentation of structures, association of the subelements across the deforming structures. This is for accurate dose tracking. We have to invert the dose requirements. So if we want to avoid a certain structure and treat a certain structure, we have to invert that to arrive at a pattern of fluences we can apply to achieve those constraints. We also have to look at radiation transport because it's a transport the x-rays through the patient and determine what dose is applied. We need to record where that dose is applied in the image guidance model each day and then reevaluate the inverse solution with changed state conditions and residues of prior treatments. And then we go again. So we've done this on a bunch of patients now in a retrospective study, looking at a weekly redesign of the therapy. And this is just a little bit of a preview of some of their results. The image on the left corresponds to a patient treated as we would nominally treat. There's been some changes out of traditional treatment here, but just to make the comparison more fair. And if you look over the course of the movie, this is the accumulation of dose within the patient. The structure of interest to look at is the yellow one here. This is a structure which was to achieve the desired dose. And you can see as the therapy progresses, changes in the anatomy result in us ultimately underdosing this target under this theoretical condition. It's possible, though, to redesign the therapy in an adaptive fashion and on a week-by-week basis redesign the therapy to accommodate for these changes and maintain the dose at the structure of interest. This is strictly anatomical in form. Nothing prevents us to bring any other information into the model, whether it's a description of aggressiveness of disease, resistance of disease in terms of a hypoxia model. So what we've been working on is really a platform that allows us to link the information in space and in time, and then develop a system to adapt to those changes while maintaining the target. So the real difference here, the take-home pay in these two, is in this case, if we would have let the course run, we would have a cold spot here. In this case, we didn't have that cold spot. There's lots of opportunities that can open up, in other words, to increase the dose because of these changes, but it's a huge variable space. So we can really shift from a model in radiation therapy if we take a completely adaptive approach, which is one where we believe in standardized fractionation schemes, uniform dose to the target, and standardized prescription doses. If we have this RDOT information, this change in response with intervention, it's a possibility to look at a dynamic response-driven fractionation scheme model, clonogen and environmentally derived dose distributions, and patient-specific response and amplification adapted doses. And those are models where we're using that point in the curve to readjust the therapy, and that can be done voxel by voxel, it can be done system by system. But the key thing is to put the infrastructure in place. The scary thing is the degree of complexity. So here's just a little scheme where if we look at radiotherapy, we currently apply it in a very fixed pattern. We apply a very consistent application of dose per fraction pretty much across the field, across many sites. And it's very simple in terms of the dose per fraction. We could look at various doses per fraction. That's a domain that we do not exploit at this point in time. We could really look at very complex dose patterns, not just uniform dose, something that would be maybe slow to start with, measure the response, and then if the response is good, accelerate the process. And we have very little correction for application or response. Some patients respond more than others. Very little information to guide us in that space. So we're kind of stuck in one corner. And in fact, the prescription dose scheme used up until about 5 years ago was one that was really stabilized by the French in the 1920s. But there's a trend in the community to do this, to increase the dose per fraction, driven partly by economics. And there's also a trend to become a little bit more, less uniform in how we apply it. Because the uniformity is a constraint that's applied to the problem that really reduces our ability to look at different options. So a model could be envisaged where you would have one measurement point in this space, and then as you progress through that space, adapt appropriately. But this space is not at all currently explored. One of the reasons it's not explored is we don't know what's out there. So we're on a plank, you know, 30,000 feet up, and we don't know what's over here, and we don't know what's over there. So if you want to optimize, you want to respond, you have to be very careful about stepping to the left or to the right. So we've been, this is with collaboration with Mike and Rob Bristow, proposed a system called STAR, Spatial Temporal Targeting and Amplification of Radiation Response. It's a mouthful. And it basically focuses on the creation of realistic treatment schemes, repetitive imaging, quantitative assessment of therapy-induced change or disease progression, and really exploiting imaging systems, whatever, with contrast agents or with inherent signals, in an attempt to provide us that R in the DRDI. If we can have some measure of the response, then there's an opportunity, with intervention, an opportunity to make a change in that therapeutic trajectory. But it's a huge optimization problem. The STAR facility is very close to here. This is the preclinical component. The animal facility is on the seventh floor of the Mars Tower, which you may have walked by or may have heard about or read in the paper. And it's a very unique facility where we have cellular components, preclinical imaging and radiotherapy, as well as a strong image analysis group to try to bring this information together. And an elevator linking us to the animal care floors. So in this model, we could really start to look at how if we change the intervention and look at response, this is in preclinical animal models, how those changes could be used to redesign the therapy. It may not be comparable in an absolute fashion, but we may see trends that we could then renormalize between the small animal model and the human model. But the key thing is, unless we do some of this work, we can't map to space for adaptation. It's not possible to map to space in a cost-effective way in the human population, of course. So going back to Eschenbach's comments, we need fresh thinking about new goals and goals that remain focused not just on a cure, but on a solution for controlling cancer. And I think this is a really interesting challenge to the engineering community and the modeling community to really step up and take this challenge. Really, it's about complex solutions for a complex disease. The healthcare system is already complex. I don't think anybody could explain it in this room. I couldn't. And so we need to really consider about really bringing complex solutions to this. So conventional therapies such as surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation have significant room for improving their application. The way in which we apply these therapies is relatively crude. The coordination of these interventions and the adaptation of therapy to novel information sources holds great promise. This is what the excitement about molecular imaging is all about, being able to look at the response and making changes in the therapy. Well, it's exciting for new therapies. It should be really exciting for old therapies because we know they work. But we could refine them if we had that information. So engineering solutions that rely on robust models will allow the optimal response to this novel information. And I think these models will be complex. And if we engage and recognize that problem right at the start and start working on them, then we can come up with reasonable solutions. Thank you for your attention.